Hello, this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today we have some great guests on. In the first half, we have author Marta Zaraska, and she's just written her second book called Growing Young. And in the second half, we have Dr. Kate Room back with us, and we're going to talk about stress and hormones. But first, here's Alan with the Health First News.
Herd immunity might be achieved when only 43% of a population becomes immune to the coronavirus. Mathematicians from the University of Nottingham and University of Stockholm wrote in a recent article in Science. That's substantially less than the classical herd immunity level of 60% obtained through homogeneous immunization of the population, they wrote. The researchers define herd immunity as the point at which immunity in the population reaches a level that spread of the disease declines, even after preventive measures have been relaxed. But if you don't have herd immunity and preventive measures are eased, a second wave of infection may occur, they said. As a leading cause of adolescent death, suicide is a constant focus among mental health researchers and clinicians, but the coronavirus in some ways may have made it tougher for youths to get the help they need. A recent commentary in the Journal of Adolescent Health discusses what the pandemic may mean for individual adolescents. Time away from usual social settings can help or hurt their mental health, depending on the safety and support of the home, the authors say. Remote schooling, the economic downturn, and potential sickness also play a role in stress and risk levels. Author Hannah Slick, a postdoctoral research scholar at the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University in St. Louis, says mental health providers must be sensitive to these things. The bottom line, she says, is that there were problems at home to begin with. They are definitely going to be heightened during this time. Two new studies strongly suggest that the so-called COVID toe lesions that have popped up among some Americans during the pandemic may not be caused by infection with the new coronavirus after all. Despite intensive testing over a wide time period, none of the 51 study patients afflicted with the reddened, tender toes came up positive for SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. Instead, the simple fact that many people are spending weeks on end walking around barefoot at home might be the cause, the researchers suggested. The Spanish researchers behind one of the studies now theorize that these skin lesions are not induced by the virus, but by the quarantine state itself. Another study, led by researchers in Belgium, came to a similar conclusion. The two new studies were published online June 25th in JAMA Dermatology. If you've been looking for a good reason to slim down, consider this. Being obese at midlife appears to increase your odds for dementia. That's the takeaway from a large study just published by British researchers, and it echoes similar findings published in December. Dorina Kadar, lead researcher on the new study, said the goal is to identify risk factors that are influenced by lifestyle so steps can be taken to prevent mental decline. Kadar, a senior research fellow at University College London, said we hope that a substantial portion, but admittedly not all, of dementia cases can be prevented through public health interventions. Her team found that people who are obese at midlife have a 31% higher risk for dementia than middle-aged people whose weight is normal, and the risk is especially high for women. The latest findings were published online June 23rd in the International Journal of Epidemiology.
Thanks, Alan, for the health news. We now have Marta Zaraska with us, and she is the author of Growing Young, How Friendship, Optimism, and Kindness Can Help You Live to 100. Welcome, Marta.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, it's so good to have you on our show today. Now, you've come to realize that health and longevity there's a lot more that plays into it than what we would generally think. What have you come to understand about that?
That's the traditional approach to longevity. So the fixation on nutrition and diet is very limited. It's just not all that matters. And there are actually things that what I call the soft drivers of longevity, so exactly friendship, optimism, kindness, volunteering, that matter at least as much, if not more, than actually nutrition and exercise.
Fascinating. Now you're a science buff, science journalist. You've actually put the numbers together and actually looked to see how important it is, our relationships and how we are interacting with the world. And another thing I found out about you is that you've been to more than 80 countries. I don't think I've heard of anybody traveling that much. So you're looking at all this very globally. What's your hope for this book, Growing Young?
I hope that it will make people realize that, you know, obsessing about fad diets and miracle foods and supplements and exercise gadgets and counting our steps is not all there is to longevity, and actually that these things may be counterproductive, and it's much more important to fixate on our relationships, on our community, on the way we live our life socially, basically, and to kind of turn our attention a little bit away from this kind of focus on I and more towards we, and towards how we live as a social species, because we are a social species.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about this journey that brought you about to writing this book. How did this become so important?
I've been a journalist for over two decades now, and so I've been writing about nutrition and health and psychology for many different publications, for Scientific American, Washington Post, and so on. And in my job, I was often writing about different studies and research on nutrition and about different diets, and also implementing this in my personal life. I was quite health conscious, I still am. And especially when my daughter was born several years ago, I really went into overdrive looking at the best way I could make sure that she stayed healthy, and of course going the traditional way, so trying to find the best vegetables and the best diets and the best meals and everything like that. And then, but at the same time in my work, I was coming across more and more research that was pointing in a very different direction, exactly towards things like friendship or purpose in life. So I started digging more into it, and I discovered there are hundreds, if not thousands, of experiments and research papers on exactly these things and how much they matter for our health and longevity. So, for example, you know, if you consider things like having a strong support network of family and friends, you know, it can lower our mortality risk by about 45%, whereas, you know, for exercise or diet, it goes somewhere between 20 and 30%. So it can be actually more important than nutrition and exercise.
It's fascinating. It's really, really wild. And with all your travel in all these different countries, tell us, what countries do you see doing it better?
I mean, so I wouldn't say that there is any country that gets it perfectly, because, you know, they all have their pluses and minuses, but there are definitely certain lessons we can learn from different places. So I currently live in France, and, you know, here many people follow what this kind of famous Mediterranean diet, right? And This is a type of diet that is considered as one of the best. And when we think about it, we usually talk about the nutrition that it contains. So we think about the olive oil and how much red wine there is, and whether they eat fatty cheese or not, and, you know, things like that. Whereas in truth, it's not just about the nutrition in the Mediterranean diet, but also in the way that people in those countries eat, with whom they eat. You know, both Italians and French and the Spaniards, they not only eat certain products or not, but they also are very social in the way they eat. They take their time. They always eat at the table with other people, very, very socially. And I think that, you know, this is one of the things that makes Mediterranean diets so powerful. So transplanting it, you know, just the nutritional part, and eating, you know, Mediterranean foods in your car or your own on the way to work, it won't work in the same way.
Hmm. So it's actually being able to rest and enjoy while you're ingesting that food more than the food that's going in.
I mean, it's both, right? But If you just take the nutritional part, it's just not all there is to it, because, you know, we are, as I said, we are a social species, and we have all the systems, hormonal and neural, that react in a certain way when we are surrounded by other people. We have all the soups of hormones that get released when we are surrounded by other people.
Mm-hmm. And with that in mind, have you found that maybe eating is not even a good thing to do unless you can sit down and rest and relax? Like, what does it do to you if you're just ingesting all the best food but being in fight or flight all the time?
I mean, you're missing a really important part of what it means to eat well. You know, it's when we are in this kind of frame of mind, as you said, it's, you know, our fight or flight response is activated, so we have this kind of stress axis going from our brains or all the way down to adrenal glands over our kidneys that release, a cascade of different hormones for our body when we're stressed. And this is something that can be counteracted by being surrounded by other people. And eating is one of the most powerful things that that relaxes us and relaxes this stress response as well. So basically, in a way, you could say that it turns it down. And so this, all the hormones like cortisol, for example, they respond in a more healthy way.
Hmm. What other countries did you see besides the Mediterranean diet? Did anything else really spur your interest into how people break bread together?
I mean, so definitely, Japan is one of the most interesting countries, also because it's the nation where actually people live the longest. And we often hear about Japan and longevity and usually talk diet, and we talk about the so-called Okinawan diet. But the truth is that actually Okinawa is no longer the longest-lived place in Japan because actually Okinawan people kind of forgot about their good diet already. And now it's Nagano Prefecture, so the one where they had the Winter Olympics several years ago. And one of the important things that differentiates Nagano Prefecture from other parts of Japan is that people there tend to be very active after retirement, actually the most in the whole of Japan. So they basically pick up activities, which are actually often some kind of part-time jobs, very simple jobs, after retirement, and they believe that this is one of the reasons that keeps them healthy so long. And actually research does confirm that keeping active after retirement can really boost health and make people live long.
Mm-hmm. And volunteering comes into play as far as helping you stay well in those years as well.
Oh, volunteering is amazing for health. So when you think about it, volunteering can reduce your mortality risk about as much as eating six or more servings of fruit and vegetable each and every day. Volunteers have lower risk of high blood pressure, they have lower risk of high inflammation levels, they even spend fewer nights in hospitals. So, this really has very powerful effects on our body.
That's so fascinating. And empathy is very powerful in how long we live.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Empathy? Like to have empathy for others comes up in some of your work there, that to see others and care for them.
Yes, it's a general part of this package of, volunteering, charity donations, but also even just simple everyday kindness. So there were experiments done on people performing very simple acts of kindness. So, for example, buying coffee for someone else, or opening doors, or letting someone in traffic. Very, very simple, kind acts, everyday ones. And it has been shown that even these things really impact us on a very biological level. So, for example, in one South California study, people who were assigned to conduct exactly this kind of random acts of everyday kindness had their leukocyte genes turned less tuned towards inflammation. So they had lower chances of having high inflammation, which is obviously a very bad thing for health. So this was really keeping them healthy.
Hmm. We're going to go to a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about your new book, just released, Growing Young.